Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Virtues of Peace. I am happy to be joined again for a second installment on the barbarization of the sky with Charlie Hanley.
Hello. Good to be with you.
There
again.
You are. Taylor Ackerman.
Hello.
And Randy Olson.
Hello.
So, to introduce Charlie again, who was with us last week as well. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning author and investigative journalist who broke the story about the No-Gun Ree massacre in the late 90s with his team at the Associated Press. That investigative reporting led to this book called The Bridge at No-Gun Ree. We talked a little bit about this last week, but also, and we're so happy to have Charlie with us because he has a new book coming out called Ghost Flames, Life and Death in a Hidden War, that will be released in August with Public Affairs. And hopefully today he'll be reading some passages from that. But before we dive in into today's topic, which is focused on the barbarization of the sky in the north, in North Korea, let me just bring us back to speed with what we've been talking about for the last 2 weeks. This is the third in an installment of a series devoted to the Korean War. This is the 70th anniversary of the Korean War. And we begin this dialogue with a 1912 essay published by Bertha von Suttner, who was the first woman to win the Nobel Peace Prize in 1905. And in 1912, she wrote this little pamphlet called The Barbarization of the Sky. So that laid the foundation for these conversations about the Korean War, which is known as the Forgotten War in the United States. And so we're looking at the war through the sky and looking at the aerial bombardment campaigns in both South and North Korea by the U.S. Air Force. As we said last time, this is a war about which the average American has amnesia, and again, it's known as the Forgotten War, the Korean War. And I just want to again remind the listener of the full titles of Charlie Hanley's two books. One is The Bridge at No-Gun Ree, A Hidden Nightmare from the Korean War. And then his forthcoming book, Ghost Flames, Life and Death in a Hidden War. And as we talked last time, so the Korean War is a forgotten war, but also it's hidden. And so there's been some intentional oblivion, as we say, about this war, and Charlie has done a lot of the heavy lifting in bringing some of these stories to consciousness. We hope that we continue doing that today. Also, just bringing us up to speed with the prior conversations. When we talked about No-Gun Ree last week and the barbarization of the sky in the South, we mentioned that No-Gun Ree includes both this strafing campaign by the U.S., which is attacking with machine guns mounted to airplanes, groups of refugees, civilian refugees. So the No-Gun Ree massacre begins with this strafing from an airplane, and then civilians take shelter underneath a bridge and these tunnels. And so the No-Gun Ree story involves the air and the the strafing from aerial vehicles, as well as artillery, the ground, and firing guns and machine guns from the ground. And that's a little bit different than what we're talking about today, because we were just talking about bombing from the sky, and no mention will be made of artillery in the north. But before we begin talking about this campaign, two things I want you, the listener, to keep in mind. One is, there people do make a distinction between targeting with a gun and like pointing and aiming the gun at a human target versus dropping a bomb from the sky. That is, you'll see people saying things like, when you're targeting with a gun, the human is, quote, individualized. It's like more specific. You're targeting a specific person, or in the case of Nogonri, a group. So the target is more individualized. And there is a distinction made. Perhaps it's just a rhetorical sleight of hand, but between that kind of aiming from the ground with a gun versus aiming from the sky at a target. So that's one thing to keep in mind, and perhaps something for you to think about or call in later when we start accepting calls. The second thing is, when we talk about the aerial bombardment of the north, it's really important to keep in mind the timeline. So the Korean War lasts for 3 years, from 1950 to 1953. And the aerial campaign of the United States, which is bombing under the UN imprimatur, if you will, this is a campaign of escalation from 1950 to 1953. So the U.S. keeps ratcheting up, if you will, the bombing, and the targets keep shifting. And we're going to be talking about that. And so we're going to begin with 1950, the very beginning of the Korean War and the beginning of the campaign in the North. So to begin that conversation, I'm going to ask Charlie to talk about the early campaign in the North, aerial bombardment campaign. And at this point, General MacArthur is in charge. He was replaced. But what is it that General MacArthur was doing with the air campaign in 1950, Charlie?
Well, MacArthur, of course, was the overall Far East commander based in Tokyo, and he was confident of victory by the fall of 1950, but in late October, early November of 1950, there was suddenly a menacing turn for the Americans, because for the first time, enemy jet aircraft, MiG-15s, were rising up to fight the U.S. bombers, the U.S. Air Force bombers and fighter planes that were flying over North Korea, and they were very capable, the MiG jets. And secondly, on the ground, the first Chinese ground attacks were mounted. The first big ground attacks by the Chinese were mounted against the South Koreans and the American troops on the ground in North Korea. And in early November, General MacArthur ordered that there be 2 weeks of maximum air efforts. And he issued a directive that I think tells us what's going to come in the next 2-3 years. It says that his Far Eastern air forces are to destroy every means of communication and every installation, factory, city, and village in North Korea. That is north of the American lines, which then were sort of stretched across the middle of North Korea. And so what followed was increasingly heavy bombardment in the north. And it's interesting because that's sort of the beginning in a sense, but we can bookend much later on. Curtis LeMay,
who was the commander of the Strategic Air Command. Most of the bombers, most of the big bombers, the heavy bombers, were his bombers from mainland U.S. sent over to bomb North Korea. And Curtis LeMay, many years later in an interview, was asked about the Korean campaign. And looking back, he said, we eventually burned down every town in North Korea some way or another, and some in South Korea, too. And so that was the result of MacArthur's orders in late 1950 to really lay waste to the North. And it was quite devastating. In many ways, it turned out to be worse than much of the bombing, even in the European theater in World War II. And certainly the tonnage of bombs dropped on North Korea were estimated at over 600,000 tons, and this was more than was dropped in the whole Pacific theater of World War II by the Americans.
And the MiG-15s, were they flown by Russian pilots?
Well, no, they were either Russian or Chinese. It's not. It might have been a mix. I mean, eventually, at least, it was a mix of both Russian and Chinese. These were most likely Russians early on. And then eventually they also trained North Koreans to fly the MiG-15s. But they were a shocking new weapon to the Americans. They, I guess they knew, you know, from intelligence that the Russians had these planes, but had no idea they were about to meet them in over North Korea. And this then went on through the whole rest of the war and turned into a separate devastating war. I think most Americans would be surprised to hear that well over 1,000 planes, that the Americans lost well over 1,000 planes in the Korean War. So it was no small battle in the air.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, and early on in 1950, the Soviet Union proposed to the UN Security Council a draft resolution decrying the, quote, inhuman, barbarous bombing by the United States Air Force of the peaceful population, towns, and populated areas in Korea. We have put this draft resolution on our show resources page. You can download it at virtuesofpeace.com and read it for yourself. So there was this voicing of barbaric aerial bombardment of the peaceful population, towns, and populated areas. The quote that you read by General MacArthur, every city and village was a target. And as we talked about last time, that seems to be a violation of the Geneva Conventions and the specific provision which protects civilians, civilian populations, from being targeted. So this is brought to the UN Security Council, and the United States, the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson, does respond to this resolution. And he basically says that we're only targeting military installations. So I guess, you know, sort of munitions factories are okay, and we're not targeting cities and villages. And so, Charlie, can you talk about that response? Is that true?
Sure.
What's going on with that?
Well, the Acheson statement, I have it here. It's in the middle of it. The air activity of the United Nations forces in Korea has been and is directed solely at military targets of the invader. And he goes on to say it's well known that the communist invaders are using civilians as shields, or are using villages to hide their tanks, and are dressing up as civilians. The North Korean soldiers are dressing as civilians. As we noted last week, no matter what that statement from Acheson says in August of 1950, or September, early September, I suppose. It was very clear in our discussion last week that there certainly were indiscriminate attacks on civilians, and we're talking about South Korea at this point so early in the war. And in fact, in those very early days of the war, a White House advisor, Clark Clifford, who later became a defense secretary many years later, in a memo to President Truman, he expressed concern that, quote, in bombing towns and cities in South Korea, we are bombing friendly people and friendly areas, unquote. So even a highly placed person like this is a little shocked at what he sees is going on in Korea. Then some weeks later, and around the time of Acheson's statement read at the UN, the Pentagon messaged Tokyo and General MacArthur and told him that his communiques should stop reporting that American planes were destroying villages and instead call them military targets. So clearly it's known everywhere that these civilian targets are singled out, and there's an embarrassment over it, and they want to cover it up by calling them military targets. And then, you know, as far as the North moving on to the broader campaign and the strategic bombing, that campaign stepped up in the fall of 1950. And then after the truce talks began in mid-1951, the bombs became almost political tools, a way to try to pressure the North Koreans into giving up their fight and acquiescing to American demands at the truce talks. And the Air Force could be pretty explicit about this. One devastating attack on Pyongyang was officially named Operation Pressure Pump. In that attack, over most of a single day, the American bombers dropped 1,400 tons of bombs and 23,000 gallons of napalm on Pyongyang. Now, in my upcoming book, which focuses on 20 characters, I call them, but these are real people, the featured individuals in the book. And one of them is Alan Winnington, a correspondent for London's Communist Daily Worker newspaper. And after that massive attack on Pyongyang, the pressure pump attack, he rushes to Pyongyang from covering the truce talks in Panmunjom. And he reports that 4,000 people are dead or missing in Pyongyang from the giant raid. And then the book goes on. If I may, I'll read this passage about Winnington. The savage pounding of the capital is aimed at forcing the communist side to yield more at those talks. The Far East Air Force's operations chief, Brigadier General Jacob Smart, has made clear the Tokyo command views civilians as an auxiliary to the military and a target of that pressure. Smart directed that his staff find military targets, quote, so situated that their destruction will have a deleterious effect upon the morale of the civilian population actively engaged in the logistic support of the enemy forces. Winnington tells readers about the horrors in particular of napalm, the jellied petrol atrocity that sticks to and burns through the skin. Many people die horribly from the burns and shock, and still more survive as walking monstrosities sickened by their own images, he writes. He tells of Cho Chung-suk, a beautiful girl in her late teens, whose face is so badly burned that the doctors could not at first discover the line of juncture of the eyelids. When she finally saw herself in a mirror, she screamed and ran from the hospital, looking for a way to kill herself. For those who survive, the healing of napalm wounds means the hands become drawn backward like claws of birds. The eyelids are pulled up and down, leaving bulbous eyeballs staring, apparently terrified, from wide red frames of the outturned eyeball itself. People must try to sleep with eyes open since the lids will not close, he reports. burned little children become petulant, sleepless, impossible to soothe. Winnington suggests napalm is designed not so much to kill, but to disfigure, to produce living corpses whose appearance will strike terror into others, and to break morale. In the aftermath of the devastating attack, Kim Il-sung has sent an extremely urgent telegram to Joseph Stalin in Moscow, appealing for more anti-aircraft weapons, interceptor jets, and trained Korean pilots. He tells the Soviet leader, "The enemy, making use of this situation, makes demands in the negotiations that are unacceptable to us." For his part, Winnington writes that it's time to debunk the American pretense that such madness can bring peace nearer. It can only make any settlement more difficult.
And I just to connect with some of the things that Bertha von Suttner is known for, because we are trying to frame this the atrocity through the insights that she has in 1912, well before World War I. So she is known for this work. She's most famous for this work called Die Waffen Nieder, which is Lay Down Your Arms, which is a work of fiction, but she did a lot of research on war and how it affected actual people. And it focuses on a woman who loses numerous family members. And so she sort of like drills down to the actual effects on the body and on the family. And this reporting by Winnington is just reminds me of that, because he is like, we have this, first of all, as we've said, the Korean War is the forgotten war. We don't even really have an image of it. And if we do have an image, it's like capitalism versus communism, this ideological conflict. But this reporting really drills down to how this is affecting the physical body. So I just wanted to make that point and to make the connection to Bertha's work. And let me also ask anybody, the other co-hosts, if they have anything to say in response to this account by Winnington, or anything we've said so far. I leave it open.
Yeah, I'm happy to comment briefly that, you know, it strikes me as particularly appalling that the deliberate intention of the weapon, right, in napalm in this case, it wasn't even to just eliminate the enemy, right, and it hints towards this psychological goal of, like, destroying a people. And it's like it takes the barbarization and it escalates it to such an extraordinary degree that, like, I fail to have, like, a frame of reference which can like capture that level of evil.
Yeah, and it's all as Charlie said, the passage from Ghost Flames does mention the deleterious effect upon the morale of the civilian population. And this is all a means that seem to be legitimate, and we'll get into it. But we've mentioned this on the show before, a recent book on international relations called Coercion, The Power to Hurt in International Relations. And when you're using, you know, military force, although we have these Geneva Conventions, it really seems like anything goes, sadly. I mentioned last week the 1996 advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice. This is the UN court, which sits in the Peace Palace in The Hague, although the Peace Palace was built for an earlier court that precedes the UN, another story for another show. But as I mentioned last week, the United States, they don't drill down to the actual effects that a nuclear weapon has on the body, although there were various briefs that did include those accounts submitted to the court. But they basically say, look, if the military objective is valuable enough and we need to kill 100,000 civilians to do it, like we're not targeting them intentionally. These passages show that they are being targeted, and we'll talk about this some more. But I still have a problem with this, as I said last week. You know, they say we're not targeting them, but if we know that there's going to be a large amount of civilians killed or disfigured or what have you, as is in the case of a nuclear weapon, it's totally legitimate to use it. So I'm not making it up. You can go read the U.S. argument in 1996 in support of not illegalizing nuclear weapons. And so that's point number one. I've been talking too long. So, Taylor, did you want to say something, or are you pondering the atrocities here?
Yeah, I think that going back to the idea of targeting, when you focus on the suffering of each individual, mm-hmm. it becomes so much more intense. I think mm-hmm. oftentimes when you hear about these atrocities, you see numbers, statistics, and mm-hmm. it's easier probably for officials in the government or in the military to make these decisions and feel like they're not targeting each individual. But when you look at the suffering and mm-hmm. we're hearing these stories, it becomes so much more terrible than just one instance. Well, even just mm-hmm. one instance is terrible, but it is so many different instances, which is what I think makes this sort of aerial bombardment much more terrifying, because it doesn't, it's easier for the people performing it to distance themselves from what is happening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really,
you know, if
really
I may, Hope,
please.
On this idea of targeting military targets versus non-military targets, and the atom bomb in particular, as I noted earlier, with the message from the Pentagon to MacArthur telling him, stop calling them villages that you're destroying, call them military targets.
Mm-hmm.
I think people today don't realize that the U.S. government statement from the White House about the bombing of Hiroshima in August of 1945, it said, and my news organization, the Associated Press, carried it just like this without any quibble. It said that they dropped a new weapon, an advanced weapon, a powerful weapon, I can't remember the terminology, on Hiroshima, comma, a military base. That was the official announcement. That was the news media's reporting of what happened, even though, of course, the Associated Press would have a world atlas handy that would show them that Hiroshima was indeed a large Japanese city. And in fact, the bomb was, ground zero of the bomb was right over a hospital right in the heart of town, not at any outlying naval base. And so, you know, it's clear that there is this realization at high levels that we shouldn't be doing these things, and that we should use semantics to cover up what we're actually doing. But then there's a realization, you know, in military ranks that, well, we've got to win and we're going to do what we have to do. You know, that's the usual explanation.
Mm. Okay. Anybody else? So if you are listening, go ahead. Let me just give a number to anybody who's listening live and may want to call in. You can call in if you have a question or comment. 516-387-1449. Okay, Randy, go ahead.
Well, it's in line with this conversation about, you know, how targets are chosen and how we determine whether or not something is a military objective. And I suppose it's going to launch us into a conversation, but there's a quote from a Conrad Crane's book titled Searching for Lucrative Targets in North Korea, The Shift from Interdiction to Air Pressure, which addresses this in a specific way. So the quote reads, North Korea decried, quote, barbarous raids on peaceful agricultural installations, unquote, or attacks on water reservoirs that were not military objectives. But no one seemed to notice. Perhaps, like the boy who cried wolf, the communist complaints about UN air atrocities were just not being taken seriously anymore. Or maybe because no mention was made about targeting rice crops, reservoirs did not seem to merit any consideration in the press as a particularly promising or questionable objective. End of quote. And so it's like it starts to be almost impossible for us to determine when something is no longer a target for something. Like, everything is a military objective, right? So, like, okay, water is something that we universally recognize as a requirement for human life. And, you know, let's target the water supply. Well, of course it's a military objective, but the idea that that's going to influence or destroy the potential for, like, reconstructing life in this place for any foreseeable future is totally disregarded. And it's like, you know, there has to be a line somewhere about when a military objective is, like, not something that we need to destroy, and perhaps there's another way, which never makes it into the conversation. It's like, well, we're going to cut off the supply, therefore it's legitimate. And there's something that's obviously atrocious there.
Well, you know, your Crane, what you cited from Conrad Crane, he's referring, of course, to the bombing of the irrigation dams in North Korea in May of 1953, which was a major decision made by the Americans to strike something that was, in a sense, really just purely a civilian economic target, and would, by under most norms of international behavior and the customary laws of war, is something you don't do. But, you know, let me preface the irrigation dam bombing with, first of all, telling you about something that happened a year earlier. In early 1952, the Americans called a halt to a bombing campaign that they had dubbed Operation Strangle. And this was aimed at cutting off the rail supply routes for the North Koreans, particularly the supplies coming down from China. They called off the bombing because the North Koreans were just so good at repairing the damage overnight, with thousands of laborers who'd stream out in the nighttime and repair the rails and the ties and the various other facilities for the rail system. And the Americans, so the North Koreans were able to repair much of the damage, and the Americans, meantime, were losing too many bombers shot down by anti-aircraft crews, and they were mostly Chinese. And so the Air Force looked at it and decided the cost-benefit wasn't worth it, and so they stopped this Operation Strangle. But then, a year later, in May of 53, they've hit on this other idea, and they began planning this in March of 53, of attacking the dams that irrigate North Korea's rice bowl to flood the croplands and to try to devastate North Korea's food supply. And the raids did wreck two major dams, and sending walls of water down the river valleys, washing away square miles of young rice. And this was a major blow to North Korea's food stocks. They had to ask for huge shipments of food aid from the Russians and the Chinese. But still, the bombers failed to destroy three other dams. during this campaign, which stretched over 2 or 3 weeks, as I recall. And again, the North Koreans were very, very good at quickly bouncing back to repair the damage. And so, you know, this does bring up this whole question, Hope, of this whole debate about coercive air power, so to speak, and the value of so-called strategic bombing and bringing the enemy to the table, bringing the enemy to agree to your terms by bombing the hell out of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm going to play a clip in a moment of Bruce Cummings talking about the inefficacy of bombing, but I just wanted to build upon some of the things that we've said and sort of do some stock taking. We've been talking about the irrigation dam bombing of 1953. We began talking about this campaign in 1950 to bomb every city and village. We talked about how the Soviet Union tried to get a hearing in the United Nations decrying this barbaric use of U.S. air power. We also talked about Operation Pressure Pump in 1952, which used, was it 1,400 tons of bombs? Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And
that's correct,
23 gallons of napalm. So that's 1952. 23,000 gallons,
yeah,
sorry, 23,000 gallons, yeah, of napalm. And
which Alan Winnington called the jellied petrol atrocity, he called it.
And so that's not enough. And we do this Operation Strangle, which is ineffective, trying to target railroads, which were being quickly repaired. And so now let's target the food supply by bombing irrigation dams. So just a sort of review of this escalation that I talked about, although it's pretty horrible in the beginning, but these atrocities are getting worse and worse. So like I said, I'll play a clip in a moment, but I just want to like go back to this bit about targeting. Number one, there's an infographic on the Show Resources page at virtuesofpeace.com, which does lay out this campaign of aerial bombardment and escalation and increasing coercive power is done with the objective of getting the enemy to surrender and to agree to terms. So however horrible we can make this so that the enemy surrenders and agrees, this is why we use this air pressure. So you can see the infographic. It's from an article that was published by the U.S. Air Force in 1954 or 53, around there. And that's number one. So this, like Randy said, it just seems like there's no limit. Like, if this is the objective, you know, you can argue that really anything is necessary to achieve this objective. And these are these principles that are used in the law of armed conflict, that we have this principle of discrimination, that we cannot target non-combatants. We have a principle of necessity. Military necessity is a very important value. The subsequent Geneva Conventions replaced that with this thing called proportionality. So the military gain has to be proportional enough to the loss of civilian lives for it to be permissible. But it's like, what counts as a target is very, like, seems to shift. And is a very slippery thing if the campaign is going on and there's not this surrender and agreement. So we're like broadening the notion of target in an impermissible way. I just leave it open to anyone to continue that that thread because I think it's really important.
I'd like to ask you a question, actually, because I've never really thought about it until this moment, but who is responsible for playing the role of, judge as to whether the, proportionality is appropriate, right?
I think a lot of military lawyers are involved in that.
That's the system now. There are a lot of lawyers in the Air Force who review targeting, but that's today. I cannot speak to the way that was handled in World War II and the Korean War. I imagine there was some enough lip service paid to the laws of war to have JAG people, lawyers, reviewing various plans. But clearly, if they were there, they didn't have a lot of sway MacArthur's command and the Far Eastern Air Forces. But today, I've been out there reporting in the Afghanistan bombing and the Iraq bombing, and there are staffs of lawyers, and yet we still have, frankly, abominations in the bombing tactics of kind of careless, reckless bombing of civilian areas in those two wars.
Yeah, and I think that you're right, Charlie, that I don't think that you had the sea of lawyers during the Korean War. And as I mentioned last time, number one, the United States did not ratify the 1949 Geneva Conventions until 1955. And as far as I can tell, they didn't start teaching them until 1951. So it's not, and this is something that's come up on the show, like even if there is a law, and I mentioned this last time with Juneteenth, so even if we have a principle and it's a law, so number one, the United States doesn't ratify until 1955, but there were, as Charlie said, customs and other internal policies at play. Even so, that doesn't mean that everybody on the ground is aware of them, and if they are aware of it, applies it in conflict. So there's a real education process that has to go on with the Geneva Conventions. And you mentioned, Charlie, Gary Solis last time, and I attended a talk that Gary Solis did. I think it was maybe back in 2012 at the meeting of the American Bar Association. He was giving a speech on this International Court of Justice opinion on the legality of the threat or use of nuclear weapons. And he said, I actually emailed him to make sure that my memory is correct, but I know he said that when he got to West Point, they weren't teaching the Geneva Conventions. And so he, created the class. So this is the other problem, and this has come up also in our shows, this need to understand international law. It's page one, volume one, 1907, Elihu Root, the American Journal of International Law. It's the very first page, the very first article in 1907 that the public needs to understand this. That's 1907. And, of course, that's before we have the 1949 Geneva Conventions. And so there's this incredible amount of education that has to be done. And so maybe, the lawyers are the only ones who know it. I mean, I don't know anymore. But definitely back during the Korean War, I think they just started to teach it to people, too. Anybody want to comment on that?
I'll just point out that the Americans and the North Koreans, neither of whom had ratified the Geneva Conventions as yet, both pledged to follow them at the outset of the war. Mm-hmm. And you know, the Americans immediately began accusing the North Koreans of violating the Geneva Conventions, and the North Koreans vice versa. So, you know, there is always this lip service paid to these things. The troops had a copy of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which mm-hmm. incorporated the basic prohibitions of war, you know, the law of war, the customary law of war. But I remember one soldier telling me, I guess while we were reporting the Nogin Ri massacre initially 20 years ago, that thing was not worth the paper it was written on. You know, we would just throw it away because that everything goes out the as Shakespeare said, once the dogs of war are loosed, mm-hmm. everything goes out the window.
Mm-hmm. And I had someone in the military say to me that, yeah, he hates the Geneva Conventions because when you're on the ground, you really don't want you have a duty of care for the men and women under your charge, and you're there to protect them. It's kind of like in philosophy we have this ethical theory called the duty of care, and the idea is that you have a higher duty to your own. So, you know, if there are a group of people and their life is being threatened and one of them is your child, you have a duty to that child over and above the others. And so that kind of argument is behind his position that, you know, in the actual fight, you have this duty to protect your own, and therefore the Geneva Conventions, like, don't really make much sense. That's a different conversation, but I just want to add that. But even though, you know, the Uniform Code of Military Justice has these principles, so I guess if you violate them, there's, you know, a potential court-martial. That's the kind of enforcement mechanism for the code. But I don't think that was happening. I really don't know that. Do you know anything about that, Charlie? If there were people who were held accountable,
there were actually when we began reporting the Nogin Ri massacre, trying to confirm it, we checked the court martial records from that time, and there was nothing like this, of course. But there were occasional courts martial of individual soldiers for. And you could tell that these were particularly egregious offenses of you know, cold-blooded murder of a Korean or a rape and a murder and this sort of thing, and it would usually require a good officer, you know, to get somebody like that put on trial. So it, you know, it did happen in Korea that there were investigations and prosecutions within the military of some crimes, but not the mass killings.
Okay, before I play the clip by Bruce Cummings, any follow-up thoughts, questions, comments? Again, if you're listening live, you feel free to call in 516-387-1449. Anybody else with a comment, question? Going once, going twice. Okay, so we sort of went down a little rabbit hole. It's partly my fault, but I felt that some of the things that were said needed to be addressed. What is the efficacy of this escalation in air pressure? Not very much, it seems, and so to talk about that, I'm going to play this short, I think it's about 40 seconds, clip from Bruce Cummings. This is taken from a pretty old documentary on the Korean War, and I'm pretty sure that I put the link to this clip, that is the the whole clip from which this 40-second bit is taken is on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. So this is Professor Bruce Cummings, who's at the University of Chicago and is a very famous expert on the Korean War.
The terrible irony of the bombing of North Korea is that it didn't affect the war effort, and it didn't really pulverize or destroy their society. We never found a way to stop their supply lines, for example. These little guys with A-frames on their back carrying several hundred pounds of supplies simply couldn't be hit by bombing. The reason for this is very simple. It goes back to the bombing survey done of World War II, that German morale was not hurt by the bombing so much as stiffened. The German industrial production went up rather than down in the context of the bombing. Bombing is not an effective strategy for ending a war or stopping supply lines. It is an effective strategy for tearing up cities.
So, again, that was Professor Bruce Cummings. Charlie, can you comment on that clip?
Well, you know, Professor Cummings is correct. The general assessment is that strategic bombing more often, toughens an enemy's resolve rather than make the enemy buckle under to what you want. But in the case of the Korean War, Hope, there's a very interesting wrinkle, and this is an episode that appears in Ghost Flames in my book. And it's drawn from the great work that the Wilson Center has done in the Soviet archives. In September of 1952, Kim Il-sung met with Joseph Stalin at the Kremlin. And at one point, Stalin, and this is from the minutes of the meeting, the Soviet minutes of this meeting from the archives, at one point Stalin asks Kim about the mood of the North Korean people. And Kim replies that it's good if the bombing is not considered, unquote. And he goes on, Kim does, in view of the serious situation in which the Korean people have found themselves, we are interested in the quickest possible conclusion of an armistice, unquote. Now, excuse me, there were other factors involved here. Kim knew that Stalin wanted to prolong the war to keep the Americans tied down as long as possible, but they'd be tied down, of course, at the cost of North Korean lives. And Kim knew that the Chinese had given up on Kim's dream of conquering all of Korea. And so for Kim, there was nothing to be gained by continuing to endure the American bombing. Even so, it took 10 more months, and it took the death of Joseph Stalin. But the armistice finally was signed in July of 1953. So I know Cummings is correct in citing the bombing survey from World War II, and it's only natural. And Ghost Flames, my book, has other North Korean characters who are become even more defiant and determined to fight the Americans when they come under bombing, as so many of them did. But at times, if certain factors come together, as they did by 1952 for Kim Il-sung, the bombing has some clear effect, clear political effect.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any comments on that from any co-hosts?
Yeah, I'll just return to my sentiment because, you know, I've had the same feeling through the majority of our conversation both last week and today that We take for granted that targeting military objectives with quotes around it is acceptable, provided that, you know, there's a sufficient reason to do it. And we're taking for granted the idea that, like, somebody is able to create a rational argument that justifies that. And I'm finding myself in this position of just absolute disbelief that that conversation is happening beforehand. I have a suspicion that the bombings occur based on military objectives, and after the fact, there's this investigation as to determine whether or not it's legitimate, not beforehand. And perhaps there's some minor consideration beforehand, but I think that it seems obvious if we're just destroying the entire food supply of the North Koreans in 1953 as the one of countless examples of this. You know, we're drawn to recognize the horrors of war and the realities of the, like, the limits of the international provisions, the Geneva Conventions. You know, it's like even when we have the best intentions with these things, it's like somehow there's something missing.
Charlie, do you want to respond?
Well, you know, I would point out something that always troubled me in recent times in covering wars around the world. And of course, we focus on the U.S. military because we're Americans, and they're the most powerful. But I always became very cynical about the reporting by the U.S. military of their air campaigns, and they would invariably say, "Well, we killed 19 terrorists in a strike at such and such a place in Afghanistan." And they would never explain how on earth they know they killed 19 terrorists. At best, they had some aerial reconnaissance that might have counted 19 bodies. But they would just go ahead, and anyone killed would be a terrorist in these bombing attacks in Afghanistan and Iraq as well. And then there were times when the military would be asked, well, how many civilians do you think you've killed? Well, first of all, they would say, we take every possible measure to protect civilian life and to avoid killing civilians. Then when they were asked, well, how many civilians do you think you killed in this particular operation? They would say, well, we don't know. We don't keep track. We don't keep track of that. And, of course, that just raises the question. If you claim that you're doing what you can to protect civilian life and you want to correct any mistakes, any wrong tactics, how can you do that unless you're counting how many, you're finding out how many civilians you're killing? So there's a big charade that has gone on for generations now about this. As I said, the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. Well, that tells you right off the bat that they just want to cover up and don't really care about the civilian casualties. And this is, as Hope was saying, the military will come back and say, well, you know, we're at war. War is hell. And, you know, the old slogan, there's an old slogan in the military that job number one is force protection. And so force protection, that is making sure my men don't get killed, is the first rationale that officers on up the ranks will reach for in explaining why they've done certain things. It's simply a charade, as I say. And I'm glad that Randy recognizes it.
Yes, and I would just like to read the quote on our website for Virtues of Peace by Immanuel Kant, which is from his Perpetual Peace. I believe this is 1795. Reason from its throne of supreme moral legislating authority absolutely condemns war as a legal recourse. And this is the idea behind the early Hague Peace Conferences, P peace through law. And there have been, you know, a number of commentators, other than Kant, of course, after talking about how this cannot be legal. I just want to mention, since we're getting close to the 4th of July, Charles Sumner, please read his True Grandeur of Nations. And he makes the point that what he calls trial by battle, which is basically solving a conflict by basically seeing who is standing at the end, that's just not rational. And any attempt to cloak it in rationality is doomed to failure. So it's like similar to what Kant is saying. So these ideas have been out there, and we encountered them when we started learning about the peace through law movement, which I didn't know anything about that. I didn't learn that in my formal education. So there has been an attempt, and part of this attempt, I think, you know, going back to Taylor's insight earlier, that part of the work needed here is just bringing to consciousness how horrible this is for the person, how it destroys families, and even if the person survives. So it doesn't. We tend to focus on the number of dead. But even if the person survives, there's incredible damage done to the psyche, to the family, to generations of children that come after. So this is something that, you know, we continue to work on, and it's why we do the show. I leave it open to anybody.
Yeah, I'd like to just echo that sentiment, and, you know, but for me, we're living in a time where people are flooding the streets crying for a humanization of our perspective. And, you know, aerial bombardment of a city is the dehumanization of a people par excellence. And frankly, you know, when is enough going to be enough is the only phrase that captures my sentiment. And so hopefully the recollection of the horrors of the Korean War will be slightly less far away. The descriptions can be something that remind us of the things that we are, our whole civilization seems to be, you know, built on, these hidden facts. And so hopefully making them a little more part of our public consciousness will serve to shed light and illuminate in some sense our moral duty to grow and move towards something we all point out internally would be the obvious thing, like treating other human beings as human beings. And somehow we have to move towards that again.
Hear. We've been going for about an hour, and I think maybe we'll be back next week continuing this conversation. And Charlie, you're okay with coming back next week?
Sure. Sure thing.
Okay. And thank you. It's such an honor. And you're really helping us and recover this memory and these stories. And I just want to end by, like we've said, this is a forgotten war, it's a hidden war, and the campaign by the U.S. Air Force is really unknown, and especially in the North. And I'm just wondering, Charlie, if you can end by talking about why you think that is, or how that happened, and was there like a recent unearthing of documents that's helping us to understand what we did in the air, et cetera. Why is this hidden, and how are we coming to learn about it now?
No, as a matter of fact, I think for the longest time, we've simply been waiting for North Korea to open up in some fashion to find out just how bad it all was up there. Mm. The U.S. Air Force, you know, does its own surveying, bombing survey, and had its own figures for destruction and such. But the numbers of dead, it's very, very vague. There are estimates. This is sort of a common denominator that can be agreed on, that there were at least 1 million North Koreans killed in the war. But, you know, the Air Force, with its surveys, listed the level of destruction for various cities late in the war. By late in the war, Hungnam, which is a major port on the East Coast, was 85% destroyed. Pyongyang, the capital, was 75% destroyed. Wonsan, another important East Coast port, was 80% destroyed. And some smaller places, Sinanju, which is up on the west coast at the mouth of the Changchun River, was considered 100% destroyed by the U.S. Air Force. So the levels of destruction were undeniably horrific. And we can see General LeMay just saying offhandedly, well, I think, you know, we destroyed every town in North Korea and some in South Korea. And, you know, in that interview, he started off by saying that this was in a book of interviews with Air Force generals about strategic bombing. But he started off by telling the interviewer, early in the war, I told them, let's just go in and bomb the hell out of a few cities with incendiary bombs, and that will end everything pretty quickly. But they didn't want to do that, he said. They said there would be too many civilian casualties. This is General LeMay talking. They told me there would be too many civilian casualties. We couldn't do anything like that. So we went over there and fought the war and eventually burned down every town in North Korea anyway, he says. So, you know, this is the supreme supreme pragmatist of war making, apparently, thinking that if we had done a horrific thing early on, it wouldn't have been as bad as it was over 3 years. Mm-hmm. But it was bad. But we don't, as I say, everything awaits the opening of North Korea to really get a fix on particularly the casualty toll.
Mm. Right. And so we're winding down this conversation, and I just want to make sure the other co-hosts do not have any other questions, comments before we end this installment.
I'm rather satisfied. I'm ready for more next week, but seems like a lot to contemplate for now.
Mm-hmm.
I echo those sentiments. Echo those sentiments. I think it's interesting, and I'm excited to continue the conversation next week.
Right. So we will be back next week, and we will pick up on this question that I asked, which is why is this so unknown? And so one answer is we are waiting for North Korea to open, and we'll explore some other answers to that next week. Of course, this terrible stories, help us, I hope, to understand the current position of North Korea and why they are so reluctant to give up nuclear weapons. I think that this history is absolutely essential to understanding their bond, if you will. So I will leave it there. You have been listening to Virtues of Peace, and we will be back next week continuing with the barbarization of the sky in North Korea during the Korean War. Have a happy 4th of July, thank you for listening. And please check out our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. Bye-bye.